session number 20335, Reel 3.
Arthur Clarke, Reel 3.
The little container which the wireless operator pushed down was a gift from the aircrew. It contained chocolate, cigarettes, coffee, money, perhaps a pep talk from Mr. Churchill or General de Gaulle or both, and also a couple of bars of really good soap for the lady courier. So then we would go to briefing, where it was emphasized timing. When you reach this place, you are not allowed to circle, so you can't be early. The timing is so vital, you mustn't be late. And so we had the briefing. The navigator would then get a whole series of large-scale maps, which he would very carefully fold, showing maybe 20 miles each side of track, and put them in order. Then as one passed out of that area, that map would be put in his navigator's bag. And the navigation was dead reckoning, as usual, but the map reading, which was the vital part, was really back to front, because things passed in an eerie blur. And so you couldn't pick up something on the ground and then identify it on the map. So what one did was to look for your greatest ally, which was water, because you could see the difference in shade between water and land. Even at about 200 feet was the best height, as far as I can remember. And also, snow was helpful. But water was so important. And through light cloud, it would sometimes stand out. So you would say, we're going quite a long way south, and there's the River Loire. So you would mark that in on your plotting chart, and then maybe a bit of a lake or something. And then a bit further on, way out to the east, where there was nothing really, you'd see on the big scale map a diamond-shaped plantation with a long side and oblong one, and about five of them. Well, you might pick that up, so you'd mark that on your plotting chart. In other words, you're doing it back to front and anticipating. Now, you taxi out, the green light goes, the pilot has already got the course on his compass. As soon as the undercarriage is up, Stirling sometimes had a nasty swing to port, but an experienced pilot anticipated that and corrected, and you're on your way. Well, the weather in the winter of 1943 was atrocious over the continent. In cloud, lightning, rain, nothing on the ground. Anyway, and a blackout here everywhere, of course. So the moonlight, not much help on this particular trip at the beginning. Anyway, the Met winds were wrong. It appeared that they had backed and increased considerably. So by Beachy Head, crossing at Beachy Head, the navigator had said, we want the speed reduced by 10 knots. And so, crossing the French coast between Fécamp on starboard and Dieppe to port, Dieppe threw up some flak. Navigator would get a bearing, if he possibly could get to the astro compass in time, and the coastline, and get another wind. Still running ahead. Another 5 knots off the speed, please, until in the end the pilot says, look, I can't drop the speed anymore. Well, you're in cloud, you've got nothing. What you do know is that down below, they know the sound of four Bristol Hercules engines. They know who you are. They know what you're about. What they don't know is where you're going. And so your course tends to go and then vary, partly because of terrain, but partly to, so they can't prompt you in a straight line. Anyway, in due course, you know, it's desperate, you know, because you're not worried with flak and you're not worried with fighters. You're worried with things like balloons over water, high ground, bad weather, treachery, those sort of things. And so, in due course, navigator says, River Loire, 6 minutes, everybody look out please. Chance of seeing it seemed to be nil. Weather was terrible, but it was really so vital. Then, because the bomb aimer was up as co-pilot, and very good too, you know, map reading, navigator would be there peering, you know, on his tummy and ahead. And 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, then a shout from the rear gunner, I've got a bearing. Now, the navigator and the rear gunner, as I've already told you, were pretty pally. And by giving plenty of reassurance and plenty of encouragement and so on, the rear gunner had been trained to take bearings. And he was jolly good at it. Consequently, by a near miracle, he said, just for a few seconds, he said, I could see where the water was, and it was very wide. And there in the middle was a pudding, and, you know, two or three or more little puddings, and I got the bearing on the big pudding. So you got the time, you got your bearing, and whiz back, look at the chart. There's the river. Yeah, it's wider there. It is wide, just to port. And there are a few little island things. Wonderful. But you're 3 minutes ahead of time. Even though you keep cutting back. There's no way the pilot can do anything about it, so you must put a tuck in. So the navigator says, look, we've got to act quickly before we reach the very dangerous high ground. And so 60 degrees to starboard, 3 minutes. 120 degrees to port, 3 minutes. You put a tuck in, you see. Then, working away, the navigator has got a wind, found, you know, good local wind. New course to the next turning point. So you're on time, you're on track, and you've got a good local wind, thanks to the rear gunner. And then there's the Met were right. The further east you go, the rain stops, the cloud lifts, the moon is shining, and you're in fairyland. Snow everywhere. Your second ally. Then it said, everybody look out, please, about 6 minutes ahead. There are about five little plantations. One of them looks like an oblong, which we should be running up. Another one looks roughly like a diamond, and the other just any old house. And the snow, you see, marked out the outline, which was a great help. And everybody saw them. But you see, they had to be anticipated, because when they came up, you know, they're underneath, they're gone. But the navigators got them in and another fix or most probable position, another wind, and on to the last place. A little township. Up to now, it's only been a little hamlet or an isolated farmhouse or something appearing in this eerie blur and vanishing. But now, there's this little township. You turn, and there's the railway line is at the right angle. There's a little stream or river. Yes, good. Moment of truth. Will they be there? So you turn at your last run down. Yes, they were there. This is one of Harry Ray's reception committees. His courier was the Torquay girl, Diana Rowden, and she, so we understand, you know, from Harry Ray and so on, actually attended these sort of drops. And probably what we were dropping was intended to sabotage Peugeot at Montbéliard. However, they were there. The chairman of the reception committee says, five minutes to go, boys, into position. Three Maquisards then stand in the shape of a triangle. They have a long pole with a red light torch at the top. Off, of course. There's the chairman with his oldest lamp. And alongside, on this occasion, a Maquisard with wonderful hearing. So, you're there. The bomb aimer is down, ready with his oldest lamp. The engineer is now up as co-pilot. And the pilot is peering, everybody's peering. And then, all of a sudden, down on the ground ahead, the Maquisard with the good hearing shouts, "Engines, up go the poles, lights on." And the timing is right, you see. And you see, then all of a sudden, way ahead, you see the triangle. Bomb doors open. You climb rapidly to 500 or 600 feet to give the chutes a chance to open. The bomb aimer, it all happens very quickly. The bomb aimer shouts delivery. The pilot just momentarily sees men running out of the ditches and hedges. There's a big cart there with horses ready and a little lane for them to make their quick getaway. We're not allowed to stay. You have to go in a straight line, so nobody on the ground monitoring the progress hour after hour across the continent can say, you know, where the drop was. So you go straight on. Some brave soul on a knoll, high ground, there flashes da-da-da-da, V for victory, and you're gone. Down now, of course, down to your 100, 200 feet. The rear gunner does see the end and says, yeah, they've chutes have gone down and they're running like anything. There are one or two with Sten guns and so on. A brilliant moonlight, you see now. And so we go on. Normally, you'd go on 10, 12 miles maybe. But this occasion, less than that because of the Swiss Alps. Turn south and return home by a different route. Now, concentration had to be as great coming home as going out, because the intelligence had told us that there had been the odd occasion where an aircraft had gone out, they had heard that it had been successful, dropped and everything, but the aircraft hadn't returned. In other words, and at that height, see no survivors ever. And who knows, slight error somewhere, hit high ground, weather, could be anything. And so we return, and all that's in the record is special operation successful.
You said in that account that when you were detailing the kind of problems which you were liable to meet with, you said the word treachery. Mm. What did you mean by that?
Would you like another trip, please, with treachery to the same area? Harry Ray's area. Well, when you met him, no doubt he told you how a traitor who controlled Angers and Villeneuve, where Lysanders and Oxfords from Thamesford via Tangmere used to land. And the Frenchman in charge, Henry Dericourt, was almost certainly a traitor. And no doubt Harry Ray was able to put you right on this. And so, a man called Kiefer, German Kiefer, who was in the German Army Intelligence, he was still alive up to a year or so ago, and he gave, written evidence, and he said, yeah, there were three of them there with the binoculars, and they would say, oh, there's a Lysander coming in 10 minutes with two agents on board, and they'd let it land. And Derricourt and his wife on one occasion used to go to and fro to Thamesford, and they brought on one occasion they brought and I've got the date, 11th of November 1943, they brought Mitterrand, France Mitterrand, and your friend Francis Kmart's. They picked him up there, and they brought him, and Mitterrand, of course, was holed up in a White House just below the Royal Naval College on the River Dart. Anyway, we must stick to the air part, no doubt now. Anyway, the treachery part. Well, on occasions, Derricourt betrayed people. On one occasion, he was given a chicken farm. We got this from German records, understand. And they know that his wife, Derricourt's wife, lived in the Hotel Bristol in Paris, which otherwise was occupied by the Gestapo. Derricourt came to a sad end, believed running a heroin ring in the Far East. He was never charged after the end of the war because for various reasons, which you know more about than I do. Anyway, another occasion then. An aircraft goes in to Angers. The Frenchman is betrayed by Derricourt. He is called Morgueret, or Morgueret might be his given name, by SOE, but Morgueret was the name. He was taken and died under interrogation by the Gestapo, and a German was substituted. He knew where to go, and he went to Harry Ray's headquarters, and he introduced himself as Morgueret, and found out a lot. For instance, one or two of the resistance leaders in the area and all the rest of it. And then it so happened that Harry Ray was out and the German troops arrived. They seized Diana Rowden. They killed John Williams, the radio operator. And you know what happened to Diana Rowden? She went to Nazuela, and Brian Stonehouse would have told you about her. She went through the gas chambers. Anyway, Harry Ray came back, and evidently his dog always went to greet him, but his dog didn't come. And she was alerted. And there was a bit of a shootout. He got bullets in the arm and a lung. Somehow or another, he got between 3 and 4 miles, this comes from himself, to a Mackie doctor who said it was a miracle that he could have got through a quick-flowing place and got to him. Anyway, he was saved, and of course he came back to England and survived, and as you know, chief education officer of Cambridge, and then later when York University was opened up, he became professor of education there. Well, the treachery from our point of view, another quick run, briefing. Incidentally, these people were told that you're coming in a peculiar way, so we understand from intelligence. There'd be, say, a cookery program in the morning, and they'd say there's good news and bad news. Good news, 3 ounces of steak for everybody in a certain part of the country, maybe this part because of Plymouth being bombed or something, off the ration. Wonderful. It was rank. It was oily. It was greasy. It was whale steak. And if anybody's lucky enough to get a few onions to go with it, you know, it was palatable. And the bad news, egg ration reduced to 1 egg per person per month if available. And then interval, a little bit of music, something quite innocuous. Maybe Ava Pola, My Pretty Little Poppy, number one, Top of the Pops in Scandinavia. Or maybe the unofficial National Anthem of Canada, You Are My Sunshine, My Only Sunshine, at that time. And so it would tell them, you know, yes, it's on, they're coming tonight. Well, on this occasion, take it that you were going to this place, again, over near the Swiss Alps, rather south of the you know, the first landing place, drop. So a trip, the same, you know, bad weather, good weather and all the rest of it, running the same, but one difference, two crews instead of one to drop at the same place. Your crew first, half a minute later, the other one, which meant really they'd probably get the same time. So you go there, you're within 5 seconds of eternity. You're running up, the bomb member says, "Gah, they're keen, the 3 lights are on, and we're a long way from them, and they're on seem to be on early, they're keen." And a bit later on, "Hello," he says, this is your bomb member, "they flash the 2 correct signs to us, but they are keen, because I'm supposed to flash first." "Oh well, they're just keen." And he flashes back the 2 correct ones. Bomb doors are open. You climb up to your 500, 600 feet to drop. And then a bomb aimer shouts, "Abort, abort, abort." And the bomb, "Now you've come all that way. There's a landing ground. There's everything. And all wasted. But discipline. Crew discipline, you as pilot, climb rapidly away to port, bomb doors closed, the rear gunner shouts, the other Stirlings arrived," and then machine gun fire from the ground, the other Stirlings burning there, no survivors. So, we then, curiously enough, it's the only occasion we begin an alternative. And that was an interesting one. So we cross France, the alternative one. But that is another story.
Can you tell me that?
Yes, certainly. But when we get back from this one, of course, the bomb aimer is asked, "Why did you shout abort, abort, when, you know, it's there? You've never had a failed trip." And so, he said, "Well," he said, "first of all, the lights were on too soon." He said, "Secondly, they flashed to me, and I should have flashed to them first. Thirdly," he said, we would have accepted those two, but he said, "then thirdly," he said, "I saw in a little halt, there's a little railway line." And he said, "there was a train in there with no lights on." And he said, "it couldn't be, so I shouted, abort, abort. And risk, you know, having to go elsewhere." Anyway, And so that's that little story, which no doubt you would have got more details about, although Harry Ray wasn't there then. But the intelligence officer seemed to think that perhaps wrong information had been given. You know, somebody, reception committee person had been taken and had told them the wrong way around in the hope that maybe somebody would pick it up. And probably gave them a minute too earlier to put the lights on or something. But of course, there have been programmes too. There was a programme about Kmart. So I don't know whether you saw it a year or so ago on BBC Two. But would you like to know about the...
Yes, please.
The other one. A few little interesting asides that that came out afterwards. Well, all right. We were told there is a man called, not sure how you pronounce it, but I've got it written down, a very good French agent. He had made his money running a hairdresser's establishment in Nairobi, one of those places. And he was also boxing champion of Kenya. You know him? And you, do you want me to carry on?
Carry on.
Right. Well, he evidently thought that the drops were so dangerous that he would rather have one big one, and in preparation really for D-Day. And he said he would take 3 to 5 aircraft in one go, south of Bordeaux, in a great clearing in a forest. And so, 3 aircraft, Squadron Leader Rees and 2 others, were sent there. Same night as we, you know, as you went to the other place. Now, a quick calculation and a course to south of Bordeaux. Push a speed up 10 knots, pilot, and then we'll just make it. And so, fair enough, made it all right. Got there. The two had come in. We didn't know this, of course, till afterwards. But one aircraft, whether he had crossed the coast too close to the Gironde River, Bordeaux, which was very, very heavily, defended by flak, because of course of all the ships coming from Spain with war materials. Anyway, this one had been brought down there, so only 2 aircraft went in. We got there right on the time we're supposed to. Came in, they gave us the right signals and dropped. But unfortunately, we saw, as we went in, a parachute way up, caught on a tree, and the big container floating underneath. And men frantically running, and a lot of men too. And about 3 big carts with horses, and any number of men. This is a big affair. Anyway, it dropped successfully. Now, Squadron Leader Rees and the other one had gone back out to sea and up the Bay of Biscay. But as we'd come in from the land, our pilot said, we'll stick to, you know, our pre-flight plan. So we turned and went inland again. Now, we found out later that Boitink, I think it's called. Anyway, I'll tell you later on the, you know, exact spelling and so on.
Is this the hairdresser?
This is the hairdresser.
Is it Boitin?
Yeah, probably.
Anyway,
begins with a B, I know. Anyway, yeah, that's right. That's the one. Anyway, he used the zoo at Marseilles. If you'd interviewed him, well, you couldn't because he died. He was killed. His cyanide tablet wasn't in his signet ring because one interrogator said, "That's a nice ring," and took it. And he died. Anyway.